Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And it's live from London. Get used to it. Yes, yesterday I swore in to the House of Commons, which is a story in itself. And today I vainly tried to catch the Speaker's eye at Prime Minister's questions. I didn't succeed, but they will not silence me for long. At the very least, I'll be talking to you on television, on the mother of all talk shows. I will talk to you on any platform, in any place that I possibly can, because this is an emergency. It's an emergency for England, for Britain. It's an emergency for Europe. It's an emergency for the world. The people who rule us are the worst amongst us, and they are dragging us ever closer to destruction. Fasten your seatbelt. It's going to be the mother of all talk shows.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Having broken the mold of British politics last Thursday, the pieces are still flying sharp and vicious in the media, which cannot even begin to accept the scale of the victory we scored last Thursday and the implications of it, even more importantly. Well, nastiness is the order of the day. Crawling all over my life, my wife's life, going back to her university days in the University of Vermont and pictures that she put on Facebook when she was 14, holding peanut butter in a store. I mean, you wouldn't believe the level of activity going on amongst the British media to do anything, everything that they can to mitigate, to minimise the scale of the victory that we won. But as we say in Scotland, facts are cheels that win a ding. Facts don't change. And the facts are these. Not only did I win a smashing victory, scoring more votes than all of the other major parties of the state put together, but in second place came a hitherto unknown local independent, unknown outside Rochdale. Of course, he's a worthy citizen of the town, but never mentioned in any of the by-election coverage, never mentioned in the bookmakers' odds. He came second. That means for the first time in the history of British politics, the two big parties of the state did not come, not first, not second. The Conservatives came third. Labour came fifth, and both of them got a tiny handful of votes. So between me and the Independent, we scored 60% of all the votes cast. And despite efforts to say otherwise, it was not a low turnout. It was higher than the previous two by-elections in the country. It was a turnout that spoke for the people of Rochdale. And if, as the media say, I fought the campaign on Gaza, then Gaza won. If, as the media say, I fought the election on a criticism of the two front benches, Labour and Conservative, in their slavish support for Netanyahu's genocide in Gaza, then we won. And the government and the opposition were defeated. And that, I think, is what they find most difficult to deal with. I can tell you for the first time, this is breaking news, the Workers' Party now has more than 300 applications to stand for Parliament at the expense of the candidate. Our party is too small to even fully absorb the tripling, quadrupling of our size in the last 4 weeks. We can't pay people's general election campaigns. So it's a precondition that you have to pay for your own election campaign. And I can tell you for the first time, more than 300 people want to do it. There are also hundreds of people who want to stand as independent candidates at the general election. So it is distinctly possible that 400, 500, constituencies at the general election will be contested, either by Workers' Party candidates or by independents, many of them eminent and extremely worthy independents. That changes everything. They were all bowling along, you see, that the old uni party, Tweedledee, Tweedledum, two cheeks of the same backside, would sail home one or the other. What would it matter? Lesser of two evils, greater of two evils, who could decide which was which? But they thought it was going to be political business as usual. And it is now abundantly clear that all bets are off. I could go through, it would bore international viewers, I could go through some of the leading figures in Keir Starmer's shadow cabinet, if we can glorify it with that title, who have small majorities at the general election that we are going to make disappear. Even the deputy leader of the Labour Party, a woman called Angela Runner, well, Rayner, but we call her Runner, even she has a majority of just 4,000. And there are at least 15,000 supporters of my point of view in her constituency. So we intend to put the deputy leader of the Labour Party out of business. And there are dozens, scores of other. I was going to call them big names, but they're not even big names in their own street. But they hold big titles as shadow minister for this and that. And we are going to rain on their parade. They thought it was going to be business as usual, but a most unusual thing has occurred. And it's this, that like daffodils in springtime, like Topsy, out of the earth has emerged a totally new landscape, a landscape of people who've been taken for granted for too long, a landscape of people who say this far, no further, a landscape of people, millions of them I'm talking about. I'm talking at least 2 million, maybe 3 million, maybe more than that, who say neither of these two big parties represent us. We have voted for them at election after election, generation after generation, but we are never going to do it again. The mold is well and truly broken. And what the implications of that for politics are is beginning to run like a shiver along the green benches of the House of Commons, looking for a spine to run up. I was on my feet every single question at Prime Minister's questions today. But inexplicably, as the Member of Parliament with the freshest mandate in the land, the Member of Parliament who was attacked in an unprecedented, literally unprecedented way by the Prime Minister of the state, standing on a lectern like a little street corner Napoleon, denounced my electors, denounced my victory, denounced my voters, denounced just last Friday at the state's expense, a purely party political affair. I'll be looking into the public expenditure implications of that. But having been attacked by the Prime Minister, no less, for the first time in history, an MP, his election, attacked by the Prime Minister, I still inexplicably failed to catch the Speaker's eye. But they can't shut me up forever. I have a right to a maiden speech, and I've asked for that to be on Tuesday. So for next Wednesday's show, you'll be able to see some of the highlights of it. And some of the things I'm saying here now, I will have to say to the House of Commons, even though they don't want to hear it. But in any case, they won't silence me because I'm talking to far more people right now and over the course of the next few days than any speech in Parliament is ever likely to attain. Our show last Sunday was the biggest show we have ever had in all the years of the Mother of All Talk Shows. We had 677 live callers calling into the show. No television show in history has had 677 live callers. There will be 3 million views, at least, of last Sunday's show by the time next Sunday's show comes around. And when you add this Wednesday's show, well, we're truly in record-breaking areas. our following subscriptions on YouTube, my following on all my social media platforms, has all gone through the roof. The Workers' Party is at least three times, maybe four times bigger than it was 4 weeks ago, quite apart from the hundreds of people who want to stand for Parliament under our banner. The number of people excited, the best people in the land, excited by what happened in Rochdale is significant. I got my parliamentary term underway by tabling a motion yesterday hailing the beginning of a Rochdale revival. And the clearest sign, the first daffodil of that Rochdale revival, is the reopening of the world-famous, soon-to-be world-famous, Town Hall. For those of you who know it, it was where many of the scenes of Peaky Blinders were filmed. It was so magnificent that Hitler intended to deconstruct it brick by brick and take it to Berlin. It is a tremendous piece of renovation, a tremendous tribute to the town of Rochdale and all of the people involved in its renovation. I hope that many of you will come and visit me there. We'll be holding activities there all the time. It's available for the public to hire. So I put down a motion hailing it in the House of Commons. Right at this moment, not a single other Member of Parliament has signed it. That's how sore they all are. I haven't had any unpleasantness from my former and now renewed parliamentary colleagues, but the father of the House, the longest serving member of the House, did walk me in up to the Speaker's chair. It was only later I realized, although my wife realized it immediately, that he was actually wearing a Ukrainian flag around his neck as a tie. It can't be called a tie. It's far too big and wide for that. It was a Ukrainian flag around his neck as he walked me to the Speaker's table so I could swear in as a Member of Parliament. There are a number of constitutional conundrums emerged yesterday. First of all, as a result of a decision in the British Parliament in 1688, I'm not making that up, in 1688, a newly elected member must be walked to the Speaker's table by two members of Parliament, one from each side of the House. So what would happen if none of the parliamentarians agreed to walk a new member up to the table? Well, that would mean that the election had no validity, that the member could not sit down, could not speak, could not ask questions, and the people of the constituency concerned would not be represented in Parliament. Now, if that's not an anachronism that needs to be cleaned up right away, I really don't know what is. The second and more significant one is that I was forced to pledge allegiance to King Charles and all his heirs and successors. Better hope that Prince Andrew doesn't emerge, given all the mystery surrounding the royal family right at this moment. We better hope that next in line doesn't suddenly become Prince Andrew, because I've had to swear allegiance to him. Now, I'm a Republican. I don't believe in kings and queens and lines of succession. But if I had not sworn that allegiance, I would not have been allowed to become a Member of Parliament in 2024. That's the reason the Irish Republicans cannot take their seats in the House of Commons, because they're not prepared to lie about it. From my point of view, it would be foolhardy in the extreme to lose the opportunity to be a member of the British Parliament with all the platform that that brings, the ability to represent the good people of Rochdale, just because I had to swear allegiance to a king I don't believe in and his heirs and successors that I don't even know who they may turn out to be. But there's just two anachronisms that I point up for the constitutional nerds amongst you that need to be attended to. Let me turn to the big issues of the day. The Houthis in Yemen have sent a letter to Rishi Sunak, the British Prime Minister, saying that the only way in which they will give safe passage to the Royal Navy to try to salvage the sunk British oil tanker in the Red Sea is if Rishi Sunak sends an aid convoy by land through the gates at Rafah and into the occupied Palestinian territory of Gaza, and that he requires, Mr. Al-Houthi, requires a signed statement from me vouchsafing the sincerity of Rishi Sunak's intentions. I've no idea why they did that. They didn't consult me in advance of it. But of course, I'm ready to assist any legitimate British interest. I stress the word legitimate, but I think it's an entirely legitimate demand of the Yemeni government that Rishi Sunak and Britain should send an aid convoy directly by land into Gaza in exchange for being allowed to salvage the sunken British oil tanker. I've let it be known that if I can be helpful, I'm ready to be helpful, even though the request assistance from the Houthis had nothing to do with me. I've got to say that, or someone might come bursting through the door, arresting me for somehow being in touch with the people who sank the oil tanker. I am not, but I'm ready to help. The demand for aid in the Gaza Strip is not, of course, something that any right-thinking person could deny. After all, children, now dozens of them, have literally starved to death. Yes, in 2024, starved to death in the Gaza Strip over the last few days. Some of them skeletal horror pictures of the kind last seen when the glorious Red Army smashed down the gates of Auschwitz and liberated the surviving prisoners of the Nazi beasts, the Jews and others who were holocausted in the death camps of Nazi Germany. Some of these pictures are too much to bear. Many people can no longer look at them. Many people in power apparently have never looked at them. Otherwise, they would not be as aghast as they at least pretend to be when comparisons are made between these two horror stories in the last less than 100 years. The death camps in 1940s in Poland, in Germany itself, elsewhere, in occupied Europe, in Ukraine, in Babi Yar, in the death pit, where it was up close and personal, and where the SS lounged smoking while their Ukrainian allies massacred the Jews in their scores of thousands, walking on top of the bodies to finish off anyone who seemed to have a flicker of life left. Of course, in terms of quantum, what's happening in Gaza cannot be compared to the Holocaust. 6 million Jews alone died in the Holocaust. Tens of millions of people died at the hands of the Nazi beasts. That has not happened in Gaza. But the intention is just the same. It's a genocidal intention. And the character of the suffering is just the same. If you starve a baby to death in Gaza, it looks just like a starving baby in one of the death camps of the Holocaust. If you mercilessly cut down with shot and shell, rocket and missile, from land, from sea, from air, a captive people in a cage, what is the difference between that and what happened in the Warsaw ghetto? And what is the difference between the uprising of the Jews in the Warsaw uprising and the uprising of the Palestinian people in the face of the genocide which the ICJ, the highest court in the world, has already found to be a plausible description of Israeli conduct in the Gaza Strip? Nobody wants to know about that in Britain. Nobody televised the ICJ deliberations, not even their finding, when they sent Israel for trial on charges of genocide and issued a list of peremptory directives that Israel must immediately comply with, which would have stopped the killing, but which has not stopped the killing. Now, Joe Biden, with his ice cream cone, about to describe the State of the Union in the American capital, Washington, D.C., just about now, certainly within the next few hours, he keeps saying there's going to be a ceasefire. Laughing gas, Kamala Harris, says that we must have an immediate ceasefire for 6 weeks, at which point the killing would begin again. I say finally to you, I've seen too many ceasefires. I've been in this Palestine cause for more than 50 years. I've seen ceasefires come, and I've seen them inevitably go. We need much more than a ceasefire in Gaza. Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night on the Mother of All Talk Shows.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Max Blumenthal is journalistic royalty, if Americans believed in royalty. He is a prince amongst men, and I'm proud to call him a friend of mine. He is an author, the journalist, and the editor at the Grey Zone News, the preeminent news outlet in the world today. If you're not following it, you really, really are missing out. And he joins us now on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Max, thanks for coming back on board so soon after we spoke with you last. I wanted to talk to you about the fast-developing political situation in the United States, where Nikki Haley has finally withdrawn and Donald Trump is the heir presumptive of the Republican nomination, just at the time when Joe Biden's senility and dramatic decline in intellectual cognition has become ever more obvious to everyone. It's Donald Trump for president in November, isn't it?
Well, first of all, George, congratulations on such a huge victory. As I said on Twitter, it's a rare glint of hope in the midst of Gaza's dark night. And maybe I'll be joining you there at some point. To talk more about what we're going to talk about now in front of an audience in London, if I'm allowed in.
Yes, you will be.
Inshallah. And what we're experiencing here in the United States is a moment of extreme political uncertainty. No one knows who will be the nominee for the Democratic Party, given that most voters, Democratic voters who voted for Biden in 2020, consider his age to be a serious issue, which may even be disqualifying. But they're just storming him through all of these primaries, hoping that he can pass through without any opposition. And he will face, likely, Donald Trump, who's facing all sorts of indictments amid a campaign of obvious lawfare in which the Democratic party elite is freaking out because the Supreme Court is refusing to disqualify Donald Trump from certain ballots. And so it looks like he will stand for election. And then you have an electorate that is less enthusiastic about either candidate than even among Trump's own base than we've seen in the past. And you're witnessing this dramatic protest vote against Joe Biden, particularly in areas where there are more highly educated young people who tune into alternative media like the kind that we produce in protest of his sponsorship of the genocide in Gaza. 20% of all voters in Minnesota, close to 20%, voted uncommitted in protest of the genocide, over 100,000 in Michigan. So that's going to go all the way to the convention in Chicago. In Chicago in 1968, where Richard Daley's police staged a riot against anti-war protesters outside the convention and shut them down inside the convention. We're going to witness a similar protest. And if the genocide continues into the summer, it's going to make what happened in 1968 look like a gentle coffee clutch.
I think all of that is exactly as I was reading it, but I needed more clarification from you on the Supreme Court decision. It was unanimous, unexpectedly, but it has restored Trump to the ballot in Colorado. Is that a harbinger of an absolute restoration across the rest of the country, or might there still be hiccups for Trump?
I mean, what we saw in Colorado was an aberration, because there you had a Secretary of State who was looking for political prominence among the anti-Trump fanatics. She didn't have any constitutional authority to suspend him from the ballot, or he didn't have any constitutional authority to suspend him from the ballot. The Colorado court made a very arbitrary ruling in Colorado. I'm getting it confused with Maine. And It was always going to be appealed at the Supreme Court. The judges who voted to suspend Trump did so on very weak grounds. And so I'm not surprised that this happened. And I think the freakout we're seeing by the Democrats, by the kind of party establishment, is relating to the fact that it's going to be very difficult to disqualify him from other ballots. But I think, you know, for those who are true Democrats, small D Democrats, we need to understand the danger of a highly politicized campaign to strip someone from their ability to run for office, an incumbent president, solely on the basis of the fact that they're seen as a rogue figure by the opposition. It's the kind of politics that takes place in countries where the U.S. imposes sanctions and alleges that elections were stolen or rigged, where the U.S. is current, what the U.S. is currently doing to Venezuela, which has suspended a putschist insurrectionist candidate funded by the United States and trained by the United States, Maria Corina Machado, from standing against incumbent President Nicolas Maduro in the upcoming elections. The U.S. is doing the same thing within its own borders.
Yes. Now, of course, they're running out of time for the lawfare, aren't they? I mean, it's already March. The election is in November. Given the snail's pace at which U.S. justice or injustice travels, it's overwhelmingly likely that it will be Trump versus Biden.
Yeah. Can you imagine the debates? I mean, Trump has had his own problems with slurring, but... When Joe Biden drifts off after about a minute or two, he was actually on a late night talk show in the U.S. and was mocking Donald Trump's age and trailed off himself and said, well, never mind. So the debates are going to be incredibly interesting. It's going to be a sad commentary on the state of the American political system and on the party establishment in both parties. But especially within the Democratic Party, where a plurality of Democrats want to replace Biden, feel like their intelligence is being insulted by having such an uncharismatic figure who's not even present, who was determined by a Justice Department solicitor general to not be mentally competent enough to be fully aware of his own son's corruption in the Burisma case. I think there's a lot of discontentment aside from the Gaza issue. And then we haven't even talked about the economy, which I assume you're experiencing the same thing across the puddle there, where average people just can't afford, they just can't afford groceries anymore.
Quite. Now, we've not talked about laughing gas, Kamala. Is there a possibility, even at this late hour, that she might actually be shoehorned in instead of Joe? Maybe his bath chair slips or some other mishap, and that they put her in? Is that even still possible at this stage?
I mean, the Democrats would have to be incredibly Machiavellian to do something like that. They would decide to lose the general election to Donald Trump and decide that it's easier for them to be throwing rocks on the outside of the White House. They always raise a ton of money when Donald Trump is president. The media elite love Donald Trump in office. People actually watch their conspiracy programs like Rachel Maddow's, which spent 4 years convincing her audience that Donald Trump would eventually be removed from office, arrested and jailed for his ties, secret ties to Vladimir Putin and his collusion with Russia. None of this turned out to be true, but Rachel Maddow made herself into a major celebrity, made millions of dollars, is now on the lecture circuit, earning tons of money. So they may actually want Donald Trump to win. There's no way they're going to win with Kamala Harris, who has never won a delegate in any presidential election in her life. An unknown character actually beat Joe Biden in American Samoa last night, who had never campaigned there. He won 3 delegates. That's more than Kamala Harris has ever won. Kamala Harris's popularity for a black vice president, for the first black vice president, is low among black voters compared to other black public figures who have stood for the presidency, like, for example, Jesse Jackson. She's essentially someone who's been placed there by Obama from behind the curtain, just as Joe Biden was. And if you look at her numbers among the general electorate, she's less popular than Joe Biden. The Biden administration, their public relations team, has sought to hide her from view, and they're allowing her to surface for 2 reasons. One, Biden is unable to handle the rigors of the presidential stump or the campaign. And number 2, the unpopularity of Biden among minority and young voters, specifically related to the issue of Gaza, which is why Kamala Harris was trotted out to Selma, Alabama, this historically significant civil rights site, to call for a phony ceasefire. And after she waited for the applause line, then she said for 6 weeks, meaning Israel gets a genocidal vacation.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. Does that seem to mean that there will be a 6-week ceasefire? Can we infer that the U.S. still has enough control over its own attack dog, Netanyahu, to be able to pull that off?
What I think the U.S. has been doing, whether it's in Doha or elsewhere, is trying to get the Israelis on the same page for a 6-week genocide vacation. And once they got the Israelis to agree to that, they started to point the finger at Hamas, to blame Hamas for the starvation of people in Gaza, to blame Hamas for the aid not getting in, and declare that until Hamas accepts this 6-week, quote unquote, humanitarian pause, the aid couldn't go in. And now everything is on Hamas's shoulders, which means that Israel and the U.S. are working hand in glove to twist Hamas's arm on the issue of prisoners, because Israel doesn't want any of the major security prisoners, which it holds in prisons in Israel and the West Bank, like Marwan Barghouti, to come out. The thing that Israel fears most is a national unity government, a Palestinian national unity government that features Hamas, without Hamas taking the lead and a popular figure like Barghouti at its head. So all of these negotiations, to me, feel like the U.S. acting in its historic role as Israel's lawyer.
Yeah. Let's switch theaters for a moment. Today in Kiev, Mayor Klitschko signed an edict abolishing Tchaikovsky Street and renaming it Victoria Nuland Street. You can see why Tchaikovsky, Victoria Nuland, I mean, in historical terms, cultural terms, you can see the reasons why. Tell us what you think. What you, you know, I think it was Talleyrand said on the death of a political opponent. What did he mean by that? What does Victoria Nuland's resignation or retirement mean? What does she mean by that?
Did that actually happen? They changed the name of the street?
Yes. Yes, this day. This day.
I mean, it just shows you how debased and cartoonish the post-Maidan regime installed by Victoria Nuland in Kiev has become. They would replace a street named for a famous Russian composer with a scarcely known neoconservative U.S. operative who served in Republican and Democratic administrations. Now, honestly, don't know precisely why Victoria Nuland resigned. There may have been some major disagreement about the plan for Ukraine. She was openly pushing for a major U.S. delivery of aid and weapons to persecute the war, to take the fight to Russia with ATACMS, long-range missiles. She clearly wanted attacks on Crimea, attacks on Russian territory, like the kind of terror attacks we've seen on Belgorod, where a Christmas festival was attacked, where people have been civilians killed in the street because Ukraine is performing so poorly on the battlefield. It may be that she was pushed out because the Biden administration is forced to accept reality. They've been mugged by reality, as the veteran neocon Irving Kristol said. And they've installed in her place as a sort of placeholder. I think his name is John Moss. He's someone who helped preside over the disastrous but much needed U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. But we can deduce, just given the trajectory of Victoria Nuland's career and her legacy, that her resignation has everything to do with the failure of the Ukraine proxy war. This is someone who installed Vitaly Klitschko into office in the first place. She said in her leaked phone call with Jeffrey Piat, then the U.S. ambassador in 2014, that Klitsch should stay on the outside, and Yats, referring to Arseniy Yatsenyuk, the Ukrainian zillionaire oligarch, should get the attaboy. In other words, he becomes the first president of this unelected putschist coup regime. Maybe she's no longer able to pull strings in Kiev. And it's also worth noting that Vitaly Klitschko has openly criticized Vladimir Zelensky, who is under pressure from all sides, and accused him, ironically, of running an anti-democratic regime. So Klitschko could be in the running for the presidency, as could the Ukrainian former chief of staff of the military, who Victoria Nuland was actually recently in Kiev. She was actually recently there in order to try to paper over and quell a dispute between him and Vladimir Zelensky. And it looks like she failed there. Well, one thing I can say for sure is Victoria Nuland will return to a place like the think tank she founded, the Center for New American Security, which is funded by the arms industry, which she said must be whose profits she said must be considered when Americans support, whether in American support for Ukrainian aid. In other words, she guaranteed herself her next paycheck through her role in the Ukraine proxy war. This is the kind of corruption, just criminal corruption, that's been legalized inside the Beltway as officials like her pass through the revolving door. But yeah, the Ukrainian proxy war should have ended by now. The failure of the Ukrainian forces to hold Avdiivka means they can no longer attack the Donbass. NATO weapons have failed to turn the tide of battle. The German tanks that we were told would help deliver, and Bradley Stryker vehicles that were said to be the magic bullet for Ukraine's counteroffensive are being destroyed at rapid rates. And all the profits, as Victoria Nuland said, are coming back to the suburbs of Washington, D.C., and places like Texas and Colorado and California, where the arms industry is based. Meanwhile, graves of 17-year-old Ukrainian girls are being found now in Ukrainian military cemeteries. That's blood on Victoria Nuland's hands.
Indeed so. Max, you and me in the Houses of Parliament over the next couple of months, it's a rain check, as you say, on your side of the puddle. Max Blumenthal, a prince amongst men, and the editor of the Grey Zone News. Thank you for joining us. I much appreciate it. Will Galloway's election coalition cost Starmer a majority? You can vote now, yes or no. 23,500 people have already voted. Torwin says, Max is the man, and gives me faith that real journalism is not truly dead as long as people like him and Aaron and a few others still exist. Amen to that, Torwin. Let me take a quick break and then I'll be right back.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Well, you get both of my films, Killing Kelly and The Killings of Tony Blair, free of charge if you subscribe to my Patreon, patreon.com/George Galloway. For less than the price of a cup of tea per week, you can support my work. I hope you will do it. Now, Sunday's podcast was a record. Currently, it's number 5 in Turkey, 4 in Thailand, and 1 in Vietnam. Good morning, Vietnam, where we are the number 1 political podcast on Apple. It's currently higher in the UK politics chart than The Times, Russell Brand, and Owen Jones. How about that, then? Still lots of comments coming in about the opening hour almost of the show and about my win in Rochdale. Rhys J says, finally a man I can support and get behind. Will be the first time I go to the polls when this chap goes national. Thank you for that. Keel Jones says, the press will harass Gigi but won't dig into Prince Andrew's life though. And Fran Harwood says, you're the man to do it, George. You've been through it all before. You're made of tough stuff and even stronger now, by the grace of God. Thank you. Angela Sharif says, how many Workers' Party candidates have we got, George? Can you ask Corbyn to join? Well, I haven't seen Mr. Corbyn yet since returning to Parliament yesterday morning. I expected him to sit beside me, as he almost always did in the last 37 years. But he wasn't in for PMQs. He won't join our Workers' Party, and that's fine. What I have said is that he should launch a coalition, an alliance, and he should lead it. I'll support it. He should be the leader of it. But he's not as yet in a position to announce that, I think. El Mission says, I do love seeing the MP title added to Gigi's caption. Crack on, Gigi. Rabbi David Miviser was a guest on the show just a few months ago. He's one of the many thousands of Jewish community heroes that have been actively, not just passively, but actively protesting this genocide in Gaza from the very beginning. And I'm very glad to say he joins us again now. Rabbi David, thank you for coming on the Mother of All Talk Shows again. I'm glad that both of us are fans of the hat. I'm glad to say if we can adjust your camera shot a little, we'll get a better view of your hat so that it can be compared with mine. That's it. Perfect. Perfect. Rabbi, what are you thinking about the statement from Kamala Harris, there needs to be an immediate ceasefire, applause line, for at least 6 weeks? What's the meaning of that? How cynical is it? How likely is it to come to pass?
Well, it's completely cynical. I'm glad you asked that question. And what I think is 6 weeks from now is when the majority of the Democratic Party primaries will be over. So she's looking for a way for the Biden administration to look like it's doing something good so that people will come out and support it in the primaries, instead of getting the kind of votes that they've been getting like they did yesterday in Minnesota, where 20% of the Democrats who even bother going to the polls say that they're uncommitted. They don't support Joe Biden, right? So to say that they want a ceasefire or a pause for 6 weeks, and then, you can start killing them again after 6 weeks when the primaries are over. It's totally cynical. And you know, if they wanted a ceasefire, they could just pull Israel's chain and Israel would have to stop. The weapons, the bombs, everything comes from the U.S., paid for by U.S. taxpayers, forced into it by the Biden administration. They can make it stop in a day if they want it.
Elsewhere in North America, we'll come back to Gaza, but elsewhere in North America, there's breaking news that Canada is going to refund UNRWA. All these countries that on Israel's fake allegations canceled their subscriptions and subventions to UNRWA, the main source of food, of medicine, of schooling, of all services in the Gaza Strip. All these countries that stopped paying on what turned out to be an entirely bogus set of Israeli allegations that named UNRWA personnel were involved in the events of October the 7th. I mean, we're glad if it's true that Canada are resuming, but what does it tell you about these Western governments that they stopped paying on such baseless allegations?
They're just subservient to Zionist interests. You know, I think the leadership of these countries is afraid of losing support of Zionist donors. That's what I think it is. You know, just the very next day after Israel made those allegations, which was the day that the International Court of Justice upheld South Africa's claim, that day is when Israel released this kind of fake information that was never backed up by anything. And that day, countries like Canada and others immediately stopped supporting UNRWA, as you said. And now Canada is resuming it. I think another thing we can learn from that is how important it is for us to keep up the pressure on our government. You know, the minister responsible for this, who I'll just say shamefully, he's from a Muslim country. He's very supported. He was supported by Muslim Canadians who were proud of him to become a minister. He was booed and he was harassed and he was followed around and he couldn't go to meetings and he had to shut down his events. And this went on and on and on with so much pressure. So finally, they are resuming $25 million of support for UNRWA this month. And they said they'll continue to support UNRWA, as they should.
Well, protest works, Rabbi. That's why they're trying to shut it down in your country and in mine. And more of that coming up later, I'm sure. Going back then to the situation in Gaza, how did you view the, for me, grotesque spectacle of American-supplied bombs raining down on the Gaza Strip whilst on the beach, actually more often in the sea, were landing American parachutes with enough packed lunches for just 28,000 people out of 2.3 million, and just once on one day. This is almost obscene, isn't it?
It's bizarre theater. That's all it is. Again, the U.S. could just snap its fingers and make Israel open up the two border crossings where thousands of trucks have been sitting for months. There are thousands of trucks loaded with food, medical supplies, housing, and they're being held up by the Netanyahu government with complete complicity from the U.S. So airdropping food is, you know, it's beyond theater. It's, to me, I thought it was like during deer hunting season, airdropping bales of hay. So the deer would come out of the forest and the hunters could shoot them, because that's what happened. Starving people ran to get food and were shot dead. I got a message from a woman in Gaza who I've been helping and supporting for months, saying that her 18-year-old nephew, this was yesterday, George, this happened just yesterday, her 18-year-old nephew went to get flour from one of these things, and he was shot dead, an 18-year-old boy. And his mother's left alone because his father was killed previously. So the U.S. wanted to get food to Palestinians. It could do it like right away. It could just do it.
Wow. Rabbi, yeah. I'm not blowing smoke at you. I think that Jews like you that oppose all of this are the bravest people on the earth, particularly there in Israel. It's a small number, but it is amongst the most courageous in the world. I'm talking about religious Jews like you and secular Jews like Miko Peled and others. What is it like being Jewish community, but taking the line that you're taking?
Okay, I have to like hold off on that idea that we're the most courageous people in the world. We're not. We're totally not. There are people living in Gaza and other Palestinians in the West Bank and Palestinians in refugee camps all over the Middle East, and many, 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 many other people manifest far more courage than it takes for someone like me, you know, living in a very comfortable situation, to just speak out and say what has to be said, right? So I appreciate the intention of what you said, but I can't let that pass. I refuse to accept that compliment. But you ask, why is it so difficult? Oh man, over the last few decades, actually, even in the course of my lifetime that I can remember, Judaism and Jewish institutions have been really taken over by Zionism and by the supremacy of Israel, to the point where right now, if somebody wanted to join a synagogue and they say, you know, I want to join this synagogue, but I don't believe in God and I don't keep the Sabbath and, you know, I eat pork and I never pray, but I want to be a member of the synagogue. They're, oh, welcome. Of course, we want you. Just come in and join us. But a person who's been a member of a synagogue for 20 or 30 years and says, you know, what Israel's doing, that's genocide. I can't support it. That person's going to be ostracized and removed from the synagogue. I mean, I know many people. People are contacting me as a rabbi saying that's happened to them, that part of their life is being in a synagogue and now there's no place for them to go. You know, so I'm making the point that Jewish institutions, tragically, synagogues have been really like occupied by Zionism. And to stand up against that is difficult. I don't know how much courage or bravery it takes, but it's difficult. And there are many, many, many of us. And we, I think, will become the majority of Jews. I don't know if we'll be able to replicate large, influential institutions, but it's, you know, that is coming. And right now, it's like an emotional struggle for many Jewish people, because they can be very easily.
It must be It must be.
Yeah.
And I stand corrected for the reasons that you gave. I suppose I'm thinking about the moral courage to be a dissident in such an overwhelming hegemonic sea of Zionism. And you make the point that one day, God willing, you'll be the majority. I'm not old enough to remember, but I'm a historian enough to remember when once upon a time you were the majority. It's a little known fact that the only Jewish member of the British cabinet of Prime Minister Arthur Balfour, who made the infamous Balfour Declaration, the only Jewish cabinet member at that time opposed the Balfour Declaration. And at that time, the great majority of Jews were socialists, communists, leftists, progressives. They were the greatest people on the earth, actually, at that time. And Zionism represented a tiny sliver of Jewish opinion at the time that the Balfour Declaration was made.
That's right. Even when I was growing up in the 1950s and 60s in America, in the Reform Jewish movement, people were opposed to Zionism. There was no adulation of Israel. Even the reason why Reform temples are called temples was to make the point that the temple that was destroyed in Jerusalem by the Romans in the year 70, close to 2,000 years ago, is gone. And the synagogue that's here in our town that we go to, the place where we go, that's really the temple. We don't need to replace that old one. We're not yearning to go back to where it was, right? The place where we live, that's our home, right? And what we do there, that's our religious activity. So instead of actually calling it a synagogue, they call it a temple. That's where that comes from. And Zionism wasn't that popular, really, I think, until after 1967, in the 70s. You can see it coming on. And now it's become in the mainstream Jewish institutions. It is the absolutely dominant position, but it didn't always be that way. And it doesn't need to be that way, and I don't imagine in the next generation it will be. Very, very few young Jewish people with a conscience, young Jewish people who know what Judaism's really about, or even what basic morality is about, feel any attachment to Israel. There was a survey done in the U.S. in 2021, before the last time Israel attacked Gaza so horribly and killed over 2,000 innocent people. Before that, there was a survey done by the Jewish Electorate Institute that just does surveys of Jews for their political views. And it showed that 40% of Jews, 20% of Jews under the age 40 think that Israel should not exist. That was 3 years ago. I can't imagine what it is now. So this is not going to go on. It's going to go on too long. It needs to have already stopped. But it's not going to just go on and on. It will change.
Rabbi David, you're a very, very bright, shining star, and I'm glad that you shared your wisdom with us here on the Mother of All Talk Shows. Thanks very much for joining us. Rabbi David Miveser, a retired activist rabbi and political commentator. Very powerful testimony, that, I thought. Let me know if you agree. Let's take a short break, and then it's your calls all the way to the end of the show. Stay tuned.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Well, I told you that on Sunday we had 677 calls trying to get on the show. It's a Wednesday night record already, and the show still has more than half an hour to go. From the following countries, we have had calls this evening: UK, US, Ireland, Canada, Egypt, Pakistan, Jamaica, France, Germany, Italy, Rwanda, and Hong Kong. My goodness, we could fill this show with just phone calls, never mind guests, but we do get the best guests, don't you think? Let's take some calls. Andrew is in Virginia on Netanyahu. Andrew, welcome.
Oh, yes. I wanted to talk about the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu, after he massacred the peace activists on the Mavi Marmara on the Free Gaza movement in 2010, Hillary Clinton wrote up a psychological profile on him, and it was leaked to WikiLeaks, and that's one of the main reasons why she wants Julian Assange dead or jailed, eliminated, because what Hillary Clinton's psychological report on Benjamin Netanyahu was that he was clinically insane, that he had been driven mad by the death of his brother Yuri, who died in the Entebbe hostage rescue in Entebbe. I try to get all those words at the same time. Sorry. And he has been the one factor since the Oslo Accords that has been detrimental to peace.
Although my mind boggled at the idea of Hillary Clinton producing a psychological assessment of someone and concluding that he's insane. Maybe she was looking in the mirror at the time. Most of the great crimes against the Palestinian people were committed by so-called Labour prime ministers of Israel. But you are quite right to identify that for the last 30 years, really, the Likud, which is the party of Netanyahu, have been the overwhelming hegemonic force in Israeli politics, and that they, followers of the so-called revisionist led by Jabotinsky, whose most famous terrorist leaders were Menachem Begin and Yitzhak Shamir, both of whom became prime ministers of Israel and both of whom committed very great crimes. That movement, that Jabotinsky movement, the Stern Gang and the Ergun Gang, are the reason why the late Her Majesty the Queen never visited Israel. Just think about that. Her Majesty, God bless her, refused to visit Israel throughout her long reign. And she reigned for a very long time and traveled to a very large number of lands. But she would never visit Israel because of the role played by these Israel terror gangs, the Ergun and the Stern, who in 1944 tried to assassinate not Hitler, but Churchill when he was locked in mortal combat with the Hitlerites and the beasts of Berlin. They tried to blow up Winston Churchill. They did succeed in blowing up many British buildings, institutions, and people. They murdered British soldiers. They murdered Her Majesty's, or His Majesty as it was at the time, civil servants. They murdered them in the King David Hotel. They blew up 92 of them, if not 93. They hanged British sergeants by piano wire in the orange groves around Jaffa. They committed terrorist acts here in Britain and in Palestine as it then was. So Her Majesty never visited them for that reason. And it's odd, isn't it, that in all this talk of terrorism and October 7th and the rest, nobody ever mentions that these Israel terror gangs practically invented the concept of modern terrorism. It's extraordinary. Sarkar, a legend, is in Glasgow on British troops in Russia. I'm all ears, Sarkar.
First of all, congratulations, George. I'll make it really quick. Thank you so much for having you in the Parliament. Tony Benn would be really proud wherever he is. George, a very quick question. I don't know what's wrong with our country. We cannot control our borders. We're happy bombing Yemen. We're happy bombing the Houthis. We're happy supplying arms to all the corrupt states all over the world. The German ministers were having a secret, but not a so secret right now, conversation, which got leaked. They can blame the Russians. They can blame whoever. But you know what, George, I'm scared about? Believe me. No one is, except The Guardian, I don't think any other press has been, you know, speaking so openly about this. It has been leaked that our forces are on the ground in Ukraine. George, if there was a recipe for suicide, do you think is there a better recipe for suicide for British politics than this, and German politics as well?
Brilliant, brilliant call, and wonderfully succinct from a legend, Sarkar, in Glasgow. I haven't yet had time to listen to that tape recording, but I know what's in it. And what's in it is German top brass, top of the tree, military personnel discussing a terrorist attack on the Kerch Bridge and discussing openly the presence of British forces involved in the targeting of the missiles. Once I can get all the information that is available, I promise you, Sarkar, it'll be one of the issues I'll be raising in Parliament. Last call is from Chris in Hong Kong, China. Go ahead, Chris.
Yes, George. Very briefly, because it is tail end. On behalf of the People's Republic of China, may I offer congratulations to the Right Honourable Member for Rochdale, one George Galloway. What does it feel like to be a Right Honourable Member again?
You never thought you'd be able to say that. It just goes to show, Chris, you never know what's round the corner. The stars were all perfectly aligned for this historic victory. And it's, I don't believe that constellation has been disrupted. Sorry, back to you.
I've been defending you all week. Let me finish off here. A great deal stated on Israel, some of the evils of Zionism. Let's finish off on this fact. On December 2nd, 1948, Albert Einstein, Hannah Arendt, and another 11 Jewish intellectuals sent a very famous letter to the New York Times condemning the terrorists who helped found the Israeli state, among them begging. And in that letter, they referred to the actions of these terrorists in founding the state as akin to Nazis and fascists. They were, of course, referring to what happened in the Second World War. Now, that was made in 1948, and not a great deal has changed. In Gaza, we're now witnessing genocide. And China...
Well, God, I've got to call a halt only because of the hour. Chris, do call back on Sunday. We'll further discuss it and we'll prioritize your call. It is something, isn't it, when arguably the greatest Jew that ever lived, Albert Einstein, certainly the most brilliant, the most hailed, the most scientifically significant, the most revered, the man who taught us more about the nature of our world and the universe than any other person in human history, was a very committed anti-Zionist. Long live the memory of Professor Albert Einstein. And thank you for tuning in tonight in such numbers. And God willing, I'll be back again on Sunday evening at the same time with the Mothership, the Sunday edition of the Mother of All Talk Shows. I hope that this week we'll record well over 3 million viewers, but we're not satisfied with that. So come back on Sunday and bring another viewer with you. Why don't you? Here's to Rochdale.